And coming up right now is Carborough BookBeat, the program that features reviews and interviews devoted to the literary life of Carborough and the Greater Triangle area. Your hosts are Paul Nagy and Audrey Layden, that's me, on the airwaves here at 103.5 FM, as well as webcast live, courtesy of iBiblio on www.wcomfm.org. To find out more about what's coming up and to access show podcasts, go to www.carboroughbookbeat.com and check out our new blog as well at thebookbeat.wordpress.com for news and to give us your comments and suggestions. I want to welcome today Bruce Lader, poet. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Audrey. Good morning, Paul.
How you doing there, Bruce?
Bruce's second full-length book is Landscapes of Longing. His first full-length book, Discovering Mortality, was a finalist for the Brockman Campbell Award. He's published poems in over 100 international journals and anthologies. He's a former writer-in-residence at the Helene Wurlitzer Colony and has received an honorarium from the College of Creative Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. A New York City teacher for many years, he's the founding director of Bridges Tutoring, an organization based in Raleigh, North Carolina, educating multicultural students. Bruce, welcome. Welcome.
Glad to be here. Thank you very much.
Okay. So when did you start writing poetry?
Oh, my, too long ago, I'm afraid.
Did you have the poet's call? You know, that I was always told by my poet friends that at some point the muse comes down to them in some untypical way and says, you're not just a person, you're a poet. So did that ever happen to you?
Absolutely, Paul. I was born a poet.
And how did you,
I can
how
see
did
it.
You
I can
know
see
it?
The crown on
it. How did you know it? Well, were your first screams were in iambic pentameters?
They were
what?
Nursery rhymes. My first screams were, I guess, Charles Bukowski.
Right.
Or Ezra Pound, yeah. Right?
Ezra Pound, yes.
That primitive yawk.
And you hadn't gotten the punctuation down yet.
Or the ghost tantras of what's his name? You know, ghost tantras, ghost yantras.
The mantras.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the ghost mantras. Ghost
tantras? Oh, ghost, interesting.
Ghost mantras of, what was his name? Charles McClure, I think.
Michael McClure.
Michael McClure, right.
Oh, yes. Is he ever a cult figure out in California? Anyway?
Yes, he was, and is, I guess, still.
And he's still kicking. I see him in New York Quarterly, by the way, which is where I've had several poems published.
Mm-hmm.
And he's
still kicking around, part of the old beat generation, though, in many ways. You know, the first poetry reading I ever went to, this is talk about name dropping, was Kenneth Rexroth.
My own.
And Kenneth Patchen.
Oh, yes.
Both of whom I met just, and I was quite young at the time, I have to admit. And Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
Wow.
All them three old guys got up there and gave things. Of course, you know, Ferlinghetti is a wonderful populist master of poetry.
Oh, yes.
The politically correct poem.
Coney Island of my mind is still going around and around. And
it's still a wonderful poem. The Jesus poem in there was one that I used to do occasional or performances of, you know, with bongo and. Shades and beret. I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets, dawn looking for an angry fix.
And who was
angel-headed hipsters? Who was that guy?
Allen Ginsberg, by any chance?
Yeah, I was just. Unfortunately, his voice wasn't as deep as mine.
No, and you forgot to bring your bongos.
Yeah, that's true. So let's go from the poet as cliche to the poet as lover. The only poems I ever write are love poems.
Well, isn't that what life is about, Paul?
Yes.
Or I could say even that the poems that you wrote in Landscapes of Longing were also love poems, because they were love poems.
What?
to the particularly the beginning mm-hmm. ones. They will love poems to your students. There is so much love in what you have written, mm. and the stories that they tell are very powerful. You're a very lyrical poet. I just tell the world out there that they ought to get hold of these poems because.
Thank you.
I'm a big fan now.
Yeah, we're talking about two different chapbooks here. Mm-hmm. Now, right? We're talking about Embrace, poems by Bruce Letter, which I claim are his love poetry.
Full length.
Oh, and then...
That's not a chapbook, the first one. Landscapes of Longing.
It just feels
and,
skinny.
Okay, and Landscapes of Longing is the book we're supposed to be talking about.
Well, we're going to talk about both of them, but the one I jumped into first was Landscapes of Longing because the way it describes, I guess, what you got from your experience teaching in New York City schools, and they were not in the New York City schools, maybe in the best of neighborhoods, it sounds like.
Audrey, I think you're right. I think it is about love. Mm-hmm, it's about the
definitely.
Love for justice and the predicament, mm-hmm. The plight of the children. It was a challenge in some way to deal with the feelings that went into the poems. The children in some ways were lovable and in some ways were... the opposite,
mm-hmm.
in that it was an extremely threatening, life-threatening situation. It could be when they were not in the best of moods. And that would put the teacher not in the best of moods very often and made me feel as though I were somewhat of an enemy.
In the war, on the war front, in the front lines?
Yeah. I wanted to be on their side, and it wasn't always possible to be on their side. So what these poems are showing, I think, is an attempt to take the side of the children and what they were up against, this enormous uphill mountain that they had to climb in order to survive.
I think one of the poems you have in there kind of addresses the issue of their take on you as a teacher. And is that the student evaluation one, or... It's one that the students think about the teacher.
Would you like me to read that?
Yeah, if you would.
Student evaluation. The teacher's a loser, not a scar, hands like Paris Hilton, believes kindness can block punches, enemy knives that slash our blood. He wears Disney glasses, never had a rival gang on his case, burning to steal everything. Trucks, trash men, dealers take in more money, drive cooler cars. He should let us slide when we don't do work. Hand out A pluses. Help even the odds. The nerd uses odor eaters. Walks that snobby hood talk. Doesn't dig hip hop. Can't get no other job. His jokes make us cough. No one savvies his geezer jive like how do you open windows of caring and peace. As if riddles give respect. Could turn backstabbers into brothers. When we're only playing, he goes buggy. Lectures on forgiveness, bringing home the gold of freedom, as if mushy dreams can stop bangers from stomping. We want the real deal who can KO, teach us to get upmarket dinero.
I mean, does that tell a story? I mean, you just know where they're coming from, and how do you deal with it? That's incredible. Do you have another one out of that group?
The one I usually read is Attendance Check. However, I think maybe I should do something a little different. I can read the third poem. It's a trio mm-hmm. of related poems. I will often do that. Poems will come to me as groups of poems. Not necessarily consecutive, but related in a sense. Custody is about a situation where the teacher, one of those life-threatening situations I was mentioning to you, where a student has gotten into trouble and is dropped in the classroom, special education classroom for disadvantaged, labeled children, and also socially maladjusted, stigmatized children who in some ways have to live up to their reputations for being bad. And on the street, because that's now their new identity since they've gotten into trouble. And really, they don't have the identity of being students in the classroom. They more have the identity of being street on the street, having nicknames, being known for their personalities and how much mischief and trouble they can cause, mm-hmm. more or less. And here's a boy who has been dropped into the classroom, and he is on trial, is going to trial soon, for the charges have been murder in the first degree, because he has shot someone who threatened the life of his brother. And when I found out about this, which was after the boy was taken into the classroom, was not warned about it, needless to say, I got pretty upset and thought about leaving the profession. But I was still I was in the teaching profession for 10 years in this situation, which is a long time to last as a teacher in the special schools of New York, inner New York City. Here is custody and the situation of finding this boy who is charged with murder sitting next to me at the desk. Suspending a minute of his daily card game, the principal escorts in a newbie. Remand, he says, yours until his trial killed somebody. Oh no, not in my class of socially maladjusted kids, not when they are learning to roll with the words that sting like razors tattooing reps. Mugshots, full face profile of the 15-year-old bolt in my mind. A cell block cage crammed with his long tossed away time slams in Rikers Island prison. The boy claims the vacant chair next to my desk and kicks back. Principal scoots to his office with a view of Rockaway Beach. I got a gun stashed in the sand, the boy warns. So don't mess. The others caught wind of his infamy. Their noses are in the civics lesson. I could file a grievance with the union, quit, or challenge him not to go truant. Help him hang out with books and jazz. Try to impart my bourgeois savvy. He reaches in his ragged pants, pulls a square of loose leaf, unfolds it. Give me a pencil and an envelope. Show me how to write this letter for my girlfriend.
And what do you do then?
You show him how to write.
Quickly. Yes.
Doesn't that just grab you? I don't know. Maybe it's because I've dealt in the past with, not in that kind of a situation, but with young people who are just seem to be lost.
There's hope everywhere. You look for it. I mean, you look for the spark.
Mm-hmm.
You look for a little bit of effort that a student is making. Got to know where to recognize the times when they're ready to take mm-hmm. another step, a new step. But they are so sensitive about being approached in a what we would call just a friendly way. To them, you need to have earned it. You need to have earned their respect. It's not something you do the first time you meet them,
mm-hmm.
because they don't know who you are, and in a way, you don't know who they are, and this is something that is very threatening to them as well as to you.
So the question is, and I guess you don't even necessarily know what is earning their respect, do you?
You don't.
Yeah.
You don't, because you don't know what their reputations are.
Yeah.
Yeah, and how to earn this boy's respect was something that I wasn't ready to go for. You know, the challenge of this poem is to, looking at the extreme, they were not, certainly not all in this category of being cold, of being perhaps on the fringes of society where you might think this boy might be sociopathic, you know, and not really give a damn. I assume that he did. There was something about him that would let me approach him, and maybe he would open the door a crack, you know, and let me look in and see what was going on. Unfortunately, that didn't happen because he didn't stay very long.
Mm-hmm.
He almost lived up to his reputation. Not that he went for the gun and dug it out and went for it, but that he kept it around. The presence was always in the classroom. The students believed it, and I believed it to some extent.
The threat, yeah.
If it wasn't buried in the sand somewhere, he could get it. He could get it because he got it before, and he used it, right?
Is he the person you were thinking about when you wrote Bad Boy's Complaint?
The Bad Boy's Complaint.
That was...
That is a different student.
That's a different student. Yeah, all right. But it kind of relates to that in my mind.
It is. Would you like me to read
that? Yeah, you want to give us that one, and then maybe we can go on to something else. I think it's on page 8.
Okay. A bad boy's complaint. Terrified of crime, they snub glances at me, think they see the devil in the flesh, a black market of bad transfusions, a junkie rapist serial murderer, another illiterate bastard, sucking dry the public tit, who deserves to be sterilized for trafficking drugs. After covert deals with secret sex partners, they drag ass back to out-of-control kids in mortgaged houses, rigged Alcatraz tight. Sneak through security alarm systems to learn about corporate scams, followed by the dawning fact of their bankrupt lives. I did not think that any journal or magazine would ever publish this poem, to be honest with you, because it's so outspoken about what they think about. This persona is perhaps a composite of several others, children, high school students, who were thinkers, students who had some kind of a grasp of what the society was giving them, the raw deal they were giving them, what they were up against. And what I did was I kind of developed the idea into one student, one bad boy, out of them, but to represent their thinking. This was definitely not a specific student, and I don't want to stereotype and give the impression that all of them are like that. That was not the intent of this poem. What I want to do is show that they could think, that they were aware of what was going on and what they needed to do, but felt so threatened that they then took on the bad boy identity. They had been labeled after socially maladjusted kids. They're bad kids.
Well, it's interesting you're talking about adolescence, because one of the books I was dipping into this weekend, it was this thing called The Universal Experience of Adolescence, and it's an old psychoanalytic anthology from world literature dealing with the stages of adolescence. And from the psychoanalytic point, it came out in the 60s, and it was a wonderful anthology of literary experiences of what it's like to be an adolescent. And in some ways, when you're talking about high school kids, you're talking about this universal experience.
Truly.
In terms of the way things were. And of course, I was an interesting, it brings up, and of course, in reading through that, it brought up my experience of adolescence, which was pretty intense. I think adulthood is surviving your adolescence.
Or else just carrying it with you forever.
Yeah, in my case, it's carrying it with me forever, but the...
Sounds like more fun.
I went into the Job Corps as a way of getting out of my environment, which was not healthy. And of course, the Job Corps was meant for inner city kids. So I went in there basically, and everybody said, "What are you doing here? You're this middle class kid doing it. We're trying to take these kids and make them middle class. And you're middle class." And I says, "Well, I came here to tell them that it isn't what they think it's going to be. It ain't no gold wing, and it's not a brass wing that you can get. In other words, it's not a way out. Which they didn't necessarily want to hear, but it was interesting anyway. And then, of course, what happened eventually is I got to know these guys well enough, and they all had their different projections of me at the time. And for one thing, at the time, I had a beard, which in 16 is something that most kids don't want to try to grow. Mm-hmm. And they thought, they thought I was older and meaner than I actually was.
How do you rebel? How do you rebel nowadays?
Yeah.
You know, it was easy for us, because we were not bad kids. Growing up when I was a teenager, I had a lot of the benefits of being a lower middle class teenager, growing up in a fairly good neighborhood. I mean, with there were nasty things going on. I mean, it was like, you know, there were blue velvet things going on, but like in that movie. But we didn't really get involved in those kind of things the way that these boys growing up in this.
From infancy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, growing out of adolescence, if we ever do that. I mean, I wrote a lot about that in my first book, Discovering Mortality. And every once in a while, I find myself getting back to those feelings of being, you know, what does it mean to rebel? And what is the purpose of it? You know, are we all rebels without a cause, in a sense?
Well, you have one poem in there where you talk about dealing with your son who's been attacked or gotten into a fight, and how do you teach your child, to deal with this? Do you teach them to meet violence with violence? And it's quandary, I think. That's on page 16.
Thank you. Yeah, a quandary is about an imaginary son, not necessarily mine, since I don't have blood children in the sense that immediate children. I tutor children in a way that they are mine, but I have not fathered through reproduction.
Right. Okay.
Children. The quandary that you describe it very accurately. My son comes home from seventh grade in bloody tears. Seems it started over a girl. The bully was older and bigger, he sobs. I'm sorry he got hurt. Should I mollycoddle that everything will be like Gene Kelly in The Phony Rain? Or throw cold water on the green-eyed flames? Say, study, do what you're supposed to do. Words of peace didn't prevent low blows from punks in the ghetto. I survived. Sex was learned in the streets. Not fighting back got kids branded pussy and traitor. We didn't protest like King and the Berrigan brothers. We became soldiers refusing to wave a white flag. Warriors the way Lewis KO'd Schmeling. Should I encourage my son to return fire? Teach that big bluffer a lesson? One good punch in the throat or a breadbasket kick would broadcast the message, game over. If he doesn't fight back, the bully will think he's scared and keep hounding. Bullies have yes men. They might gang up, carry knives. Day and night, I sweat a mortgage here in the safer suburbs. I can't manage Hebrew school, piano, and martial arts lessons. I will find time. Coach him to plant both feet, uppercut solar plexus. He will learn the spot between the eyes where one shot can kill. No, a good father doesn't teach violence is manly. Should I order him to practice Kabbalah like my grandfather, a rabbi? Tolstoy, Gandhi, and Shore were pacifists. I would be unfair to him if I say being tender is brave. He'll think I'm weird. Resent me for raising a little bird. Wiping his swollen eyes, do I second land enlightening words? Study like Buber, Horowitz, Malamud. What I did in this poem was set up a quandary between, in some ways, what my father still meant to me in a situation similar to this that I went through, and the son and the predicament of advising, which many parents face and perhaps don't go deeply enough into the ramifications of what it may mean, not to the feelings of the child. Many times we think that if we're tough, you know, that the way to be tough is to have the child stand up for himself, you know. What is being tough? What does it mean?
I remember my junior high stratums for dealing with violence, and the one I did Partly because I wasn't getting on in gym, and I was not interested in competitive sports, and thereby wasn't getting on in gym. And so what I did is I sort of cajoled my mother into letting me do a judo class after school. And what it was a relatively small payment, so she managed to do it, and I went to judo regularly, and actually used to go, was basically what I did after school on a regular basis. That got me physical enough to where I felt comfortable in fighting, because that's what you did in judo. You practice fighting and falling and stuff like that. Then later, when there was issues of bullying, I knew that the best way not to be bullied was to pick the fight with the baddest person I could find in my class. And as you know, always, yeah. And of course in my day and age, in nice integrated schools, always the black kid, right? So we did it for a couple of years, and then we figured out what the story was, and we didn't need to do it anymore. But what it was is I would pick a fight with this guy, and we'd go out and have a fight, you know. I wouldn't hurt him, he wouldn't hurt me. And the first time we did it, he didn't know what was going on. And then I actually told him after the fight, I says, the reason we were fighting wasn't because I'm mad at you or anything. I says, if I fight you, then nobody else is going to pick on me. Mm-hmm. And I was no longer bully bait.
He understood that.
Yeah, he understood that. So then a year later, you know, because we had, you know, a different mix around, I had to fight him again, right? You know, mm-hmm. He just can't because he was the biggest badass in the class. You know, this time we really had L. It was just pretty much, and again, it was, you know, I'm protecting myself. This is how I protect myself. I will not be bullied at all for the entire year if we do this little dance that we do.
You know, it's interesting when you come to that, because there's so many different kinds of situations. But what's coming to my mind is a friend of mine, African American, in an all-white school when he was growing up, and this was just when integration had happened in Montgomery, Alabama. And he said he could type today because he took typing to get out of gym because he was sick and tired of getting beat up in the boys' room.
Yeah, right in the, you know, in
so
the locker
just,
room.
In the locker room. He just got beat up every day and decided to take up typing instead.
Yeah. Well, I think that children need to be protected, and the best thing the parent can do is to build self-confidence in a student. I mean, that's what I do as a mentor when I work with students on tutoring, is I build their confidence by showing them that knowledge is power, at least giving examples that knowledge is power. I think that's what the father is trying to get across to the boy here in this situation. It's a younger boy. He's not a teenager necessarily. Could be a teenager in this story. But then what happens? Okay, so I knew friends who were learning karate, and when they knew it, they practiced it. Okay, they practiced it on other children because they were taunting and bullying. So it can work in reverse.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't solve a problem. What it does is it shows students, when you teach the martial arts, what it shows is that they can take care of themselves. But taking care of themselves doesn't mean physically knocking the other person out. You know, there's a problem with that I have. For example, one of the questions I ask myself a lot is it brave to fight in the military? Is it brave? Is that brave? You know, the question is, are the parents being brave if they encourage or even are neutral about it? You know, well, my son wants to do it, or my daughter wants to go into the military. I ask myself that a lot because I'm not necessarily convinced that this is bravery.
Actually, at this point, it's social mobility. Yeah. And unfortunately, too many people see it that way.
Well, they go into the military because it gives them a roof over their head and food and some training. And
somebody has to do it.
Somebody has to do it. And mm-hmm. I can remember years and years and years ago speaking with someone who had actually been in, I forget which conflict he was in. And I was, I guess, young enough to ask rather direct questions, and it was just like, what did it feel like to be under fire? And, you know, to be facing somebody who was going to shoot at you. And he said, you went ahead and you charged with the rest of the troops because you didn't want to be left behind, and there was nothing else to do. So it wasn't bravery, it was just the only option that was there.
Yeah, well, in living our lives, we are in the line of fire. Mm-hmm. I mean, we do not have to go into wars in order to experience that. That
right.
I mean, I just cannot condone it. Is it really a vicious circle or a cycle that we cannot interrupt or disrupt? I think that cycle can be, you know, and I write about that in my political satires, anti-war war poems. I don't, you know, when you talk about anti-war poem or a war poem, I think that what we're really talking about is life and how we cope with it, you know, and how far we're willing, the tolerance we're willing to endure.
Well, you've got some poems in there that deal with war. You want to read us one of those?
I'll read Our Own Blood, and also a trio of poems that involve anti-war sentiments. The first one is Agrigento, Sicily, July 17th, 1943. Why don't I read two of them?
Go ahead.
Shells of scorched buildings in the wake of invasion. Their doors arched like vultures in vacant shadow flank the street. Out of a window, an unhinged shutter leans like a coffin for Montagues and Capulets onto one of the empty balconies barred as jail. Men are scarcer than nylons. No church bells ring through neighborhoods swamped with exploded apartments. The heat is malarial. Sunlight glares on an old woman in shawl and long black dress. Her sorrow fruitless, her hand extends onto a building's water pipe for balance, like the blessing of a priest. The other clutches a loaf of bread as she gazes down into wreckage, uncovers a dead body next to her black shoes. Another survivor, a young woman nearly camouflaged in shadow of walls, scavenges for a meal, wanders off carrying her fiancé's photo. In back of them, the shadow of a Sherman tank edges along chalky street. A shard of sky beaches against a distant roof. There are no easy answers. You know, I wasn't thinking of oversimplifying the predicament of war. What I want to do is show that there are different sides to it.
Mm-hmm.
This is a situation where the Allies were invading Sicily in order to seize the capital, Palermo. And what inspired me to write the poem was not the bravery of the forces, although I'm sure that bravery was involved in it, was not taking sides for the liberators, you know, and there were people who needed to be liberated. I'm getting into the complexity of the situation and showing that there are no easy answers for the simple reason that what the end of this is destruction and death.
Mm-hmm.
The end of...
Yeah. Well, you know, when we were discussing war, as we do with the beginning of the Iraq War, and I heard the way people were discussing the war in relatively light and blithe terms. As I said, war is an obscenity. You know, there is no good that comes out of war. You know, and to assume something like that just because you're not close to it, which is unfortunately the experience of Americans, except for the soldiers that are there, and they come here and they're wounded for life and carry incredible wounds with them, and the soldiers that are. Our experience of the war will come back and haunt us,
right,
for the rest of our lives and our community lives that we have this thing, but the mass population in America is, except for the war of northern aggression, they say down here in the South, and that one's still remembered. See, this is the thing. It's remembered years on.
They still go out there and do these reenactments, which I don't understand. I just don't comprehend why they would go out and reenact these bloody scenes.
Well, for instance, there was one of those alternate history books came out this last year, which was how America United States of America would have fared better if it had never had the Revolutionary War, if there never had been a Declaration of Independence, if it rather had been the declaration of no taxation without representation, that actually would have fared better for a variety of reasons.
Interesting.
You know, but
sure, founding fathers rolling in their graves.
Yes. Well, given this is our 4th of July show, I think this is perfectly good to stir up a little dust.
A little foment.
Mm-hmm. When do your phone start ringing?
We don't answer them.
That's right. But I wanted to, one of the things that you're bringing up as, and I think which is, a mark of a good writer and also a poet, is that nothing is ever quite what it seems. And I wanted to take a moment to consider your classical bow in this chapbook, which is the variations on the sentence of
Sisyphus. It's not a chapbook.
Sisyphus. It's a full book.
It's a full book. Landscapes of Longing.
All right. You won't get chapped from holding it. Let's put
Sisyphus.
It that way.
Yeah. Sisyphus.
No one has ever finished this book. It's so engrossing and so.
And it's well, the variations of the sentence on Sisyphus. The reason why is well, I guess we should start.
Look at the spelling of it.
Sisyphus.
Okay.
Let us.
He was not a sissy, by the way. He just.
This is right. Yes. Let us why don't you tell people who Sisyphus was and what his crime was that he got sentenced to what you reflect on in
sentenced to you writing these poems about him.
Yes. And also but which I loved of course was the various commentary of the various ancient personages, right. and their own view, which we'll talk about in a moment. But let's talk about Sisyphus first and his terrible crime, because I think this does deal with the modern dilemma of
the existentialist dilemma.
Well, of doing. In other words, we're thrown into the world to do stuff when we know that anything we do is utterly futile, because nothing means anything ultimately, because there is no ultimately.
All is vanity. Not many people are going to like that either.
Well, that does come out of
I don't know. So I come out of an entirely different mindset or way of looking at
Pollyanna. Is it?
No, it's not Pollyanna. We are creating the world as we go. We're all creators. So everything we do matters because we're making it. What we have today is what we've
made. Well, I still stick with the Stoics. The world has never been and never will be.
He's gone. There is no Paul there.
That's right. That's equanimity when you know that there's everything that's happening never was and never will be.
Actually, Sisyphus would be very glad to hear that there are alternate universes where there may be identical Sisyphus is going through the same thing he's going through.
And maybe in some of them he actually achieves it.
Which is just a variant of misery loves company. Yeah.
Exactly. Can't punish me enough. Maybe he's a glutton, you know. I'm more and more.
So what did he do that deserved? And we are getting somebody calling in. Yes.
Well, let's just talk about...
Okay. You're not going to hear what the caller has to say first.
No, they hung up.
Yeah, if it lashes again.
All right, what we're dealing with here, I don't know if I can sum it up in a nutshell. Sisyphus was in classical Greek mythology, and there is some basis for history and reality here because there was a king of Corinth named Sisyphus who built many wonderful things, however, offended the gods, and how we may be offending the gods the same way the Greeks, so the ancient Greeks were offending the gods. You know, and Homer thought that Odysseus and Ulysses in some ways offended the gods. But it's anyone's hubris, you know, or arrogance. Sisyphus is there are other ancient Greek characters.
I always thought the best understanding of hubris was Oedipus. Hearing that he was going to marry his mother, insisted upon marrying women that were old enough to be his mother.
As if people aren't doing that, right?
Yeah.
Today. Yeah. Right, there are a lot of things that Sisyphus represents to me. He's kind of a Promethean character. The creator, in a sense. He's creating his own destiny, his own fate.
Just as Audrey was claiming she could do. Okay.
Right, and don't we all want to do that? I mean,
yeah,
we become
gods.
We
all do do it. So there, people, don't listen to these two guys.
Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll see who's got the ultimate flush on this one.
Go ahead.
Yeah, ultimately, I think we want to create myths of our lives. I think, you know, when we hand things over to our children, pass things on, journals, photo albums, what have you, we're creating myths of ourselves or what our lives have been. The things that we remember about people are not necessarily the greatness that they achieved, if they've been lucky enough to achieve something noteworthy. It's about the little things, you know, how kindness is, and you know, if somebody was kind and did something dastardly, we remember that too. The interesting things. And Sisyphus, since we don't know what Sisyphus's personality was, I was then free to invest Sisyphus with any kind of characteristics of modern-day man or woman that I wanted to. And this could very easily have been a woman, a queen, a king, or anyone who was challenged for what they had, abilities, creativity, in a sense, or something that was frightening because it involved power, some form of power. And we don't, in a healthy way, we do not trust people who get too much power, because they corrupt. They become corrupted, and then what happens is we have situations like are happening in the Gulf of Mexico, you know, where the CEOs become gods.
Hello,
and get away with murder.
Yes, so let's keep, let's
see. Which one here?
So we do have a caller. Somebody, we did insult somebody to get him on the air. Okay,
yeah.
Great.
Okay.
Speak.
Do you hear him?
I don't hear a voice.
Are you there?
Yes, I'm right here.
Okay.
Good, now I can hear the speaker.
Yeah,
yes.
Go right ahead.
Well, you know, discussion of wars today and the generalities of why they're fought, why we bother to enter into a war, and the great expense and cost and such. You know, it harkens back an economics course I took, Economics of War, and it dealt with wars are generally fought over natural resources or the desire to possess others' natural resources. Yet we cloak our wars in the politics that must be sold to our constituency. In other words, it's the religious war, or they attacked us first, a matter of honor. It's, you know, and these types of things that cause the populace to send their children off to war, you know, but basically that viewpoint, we're fighting wars on old grudges, on history, on what was done to us, how we were wrong. Yet the powers that be know why they're going to war. It's natural resources.
Well, I don't know if we have a lot of excuses for war, and the economic excuse is another one. I mean, to what degree are we ever going to really make the money back from the war in Iraq? Or what degree can we ever make the money that we're pouring into Afghanistan? Are we ever going to make it back? We're not going to make it back. We're never going to make the trillions of dollars that we've thrown away. And the way that we've allowed our own infrastructure to deteriorate and our own democracy to be thinking, or the horrible scars that we've inflicted on those people or on our own people from it. We're never going to make that. There's no economic sense in that.
Agreed here, but I think the powers that be, Bob Dylan wrote a song, Masters of War, I believe. The powers that be believe going to war is a good economic decision because it employs everything from the Boeings to the General Electrics on down in producing the machinations, the machinery that we enables us to war.
Isn't it the Second World War that got us out of the Depression?
That's what they say.
And of course, and unfortunately, now we're mired in a war which is probably going to deepen
put us into depression,
into a deeper depression than the great one in
For
all
example,
probability.
How do you think this reflects in your poetry?
I appreciate your phoning in, by the way. Please give us your name. What's your name?
Yes, I'm Joe. I'm over in Carrboro.
Hi, Joe.
I love the station.
Thanks.
Joe, I'm glad that you phoned in. The my take on it is that you're talking about the natural resources, and I'm sure that's the reasons that one of the main economic reasons. You know, we've got the oil, and eventually it'll be something else if it isn't the oil that we use as an excuse to get into the war. Another one. All I can say is that the economics figures into their to the military decisions, and it needs to be looked at, but not as something that's viable, because when you're talking about dispensability here, we cannot allow human lives to be dispensable. It's just not something that, to me, is morally and ethically a good argument, you know, a sound argument. Because we need things to, in order to spur the economy, does not give us the right to take human life. And that's my...
I agree.
You agree. Thank you.
It's a higher philosophy. It's a more worthy way to view war, and I'm with you 100%. I just don't think, you know, what Eisenhower said, beware of the industrial military complex, that these things get underway, they get ahead of steam. It's just, I was totally knocked off my feet when our former president, Bush Jr., declared war on Iraq. And I was not alone. I think about 90% of Americans were really taken back by that decision. Mm-hmm. And the words escape me, but the willingness to do it so quickly. And it was very unjustified. They conjured up some ideas that terrorists were being harbored and propagated and supported, and thus we must go in there and liberate Iraq. Yet we didn't really buy that. We knew they had a tyrannical leader, and that was about it, you know. And we thought, I think the common man realized we just wanted to get rid of a guy who was giving us a problem politically.
The I really want to thank you for calling in, Joe. It's always good to have know that we're actually reaching somebody out there, that we have an audience. So I'm happy that you decided to listen to Carrboro BookBeat today.
I want to tell your poet, continue with your fine philosophy. The poets are needed in this world because of the industrial military complex people. We have to counter that with our own philosophy that we are accountable for our actions.
Thank you, Joe. Please email me at bridgesbl.aol. And if you're interested in the book, we can talk about it more.
That's great.
How's that?
Thank you. I'll continue to listen.
Thank you very much for calling. Yeah, we are getting towards the. We've got about 8 minutes left, and I didn't want to.
Unfortunately, people,
totally.
If you want to know about Sisyphus, it means you got to turn it off.
You'll need to invite me back.
Absolutely. About Sisyphus, you'll have to read the poems, folks, but they're really quite good.
I'd like to get in a little bit too. We've gotten the terrible things going on in inner city schools, and we've gotten into war. Let's get into embrace.
Now that we've done with war, let us make love, which is the reason we have war in the first place.
Right? I definitely want you to read Tango Mania. Tango Mania is one of my favorites out of Embrace.
Oh, okay. That's good. Yes.
A love war.
Number two.
That's what Tango Mania is about, a love war.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good transition.
Perhaps I should just say the milonga are at the roots of tango, coming from Africa. Caught up in milonga, Syncopation, that night her almond hair taut on one side, hinted worlds, velvet crook of knee, brazen foot, barely skimming thigh, teased along arrogant matador's hip, smitten with the sorcery of sinuous abandon. Promises didn't sound deceitful. Her eyes flashed indigo, orange moon-stalked, as lunatics swayed, swiveled, glided quixotic in Buenos Aires, where blood ignited. Hornets of jealous hate, daggered emotions into steps of suspicion. Dazzling flesh eclipsed reason, let loose euphoric folly. The blind urges stamped in bone, love's ardent lunges burning like poppies possessed.
That is just so incredibly engulfing in its language. It's really very great.
I do have a friend, by the way. In fact, I was talking to her yesterday. She lives in the other side of the globe, and she's a yoga instructor. So your other poem that I'm, and she's also into the tango. So I'm going to actually send her a copy of Yoga Companion and the Tango Mania, and that's a real a compliment, just because both poems remind me of her so much. You want to read Yoga Companion? That's on page 18.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to mention since Audrey said that it kind of made her feel that energy, that mm-hmm. tango mania feeling, that I am a frustrated Latin dancer.
and also a frustrated yogis, half the yogis too, right? Which right. I'm quite sympathetic with.
Every chance I get, you know, I'll watch these ballroom dancing programs on TV and say, well, if that could only be me.
Yes.
Oh, the Yoga Companion, well, if anyone has cats... And if anyone doesn't have a cat, mm-hmm. get one. They're wonderful.
Yes, they'll show you how to do asanas. Yeah.
Yoga Companion. She waits hours in a cloak of night, waits for my aging bones to slowly slouch on the carpet, stretched the way she does, arch drowsiness out of spine, the way a tiger leans, prepares to stalk. As I become a cobra, hood raising, lowering, she slips under the bridge, rolls on her back, displays chest and belly, white as blackberry flowers. When I try to bend the kinks out of knees, nearly touch toes, she licks a hand, taps a white paw against my skin as I flex stiff shoulders, swivel from hip, loosen leg joints. She knows I know what she wants, more than anything besides canned food and sleep. If I were her size and she mine, would she devour or look after me? Still stare with those mustard eyes, persistent about a belly rub.
You know, I want to get in, that is, it's just very descriptive. I want to get in two things. One, you do tutoring now. And that, just give us if people are interested in tutoring for their child, this is for multicultural children?
Not necessarily. It's for any child. We have had upper class, upscale, economically well-off parents and families. We've had students who came from the most, should I say, lower income echelons of society. What makes it multicultural is that we're open to students from all over the world, and we've had students from just about every country in the world.
You have a website for that?
Yes, it's bridgestutoring.org.
That's BRIDGES, tutoring.
As in bridges, yes,
O-R-G.
Building bridges.
Right.
Tutoring.org. This economy has really hit us. And right now I am doing all of the tutoring. In the past, we were able to hire specialists in math and in any subject for adults as well as children. So we are really hard hit by this economic recession to the point where we will talk about what the parents are willing to can afford and, you know, how long they would like the tutoring, just... anything that the parents would like. We go to the homes, we go to the public libraries, and as I said, I will do it. I am licensed in special education, and I've had all my life I've devoted to teaching and tutoring.
Okay, the second thing I want to get in is, I mean, we've got the second thing, I should say, the second thing I want to get in is you have to come back because we've got so much more to talk about. So the third thing is, how can people get your books, which I highly recommend to our listeners to
Landscapes of Longing and Embrace.
Right.
Please, if you're interested in the books, order through my email, BridgesBL. That's BRIDGES, my initials, Bruce Slater, BL, at AOL.com. You can also order the book Landscapes of Longing through Main Street Rag Publishing Company. And I will not get as much money as if you order it through my website at BruceLater.com or email me. And you will see my email at on the website as well as excerpts from the book, other excerpts.
And Bruce Slater is Bruce, L-A-D-E-R.
Right, as in see you later.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry to have to say that we are out of time, Bruce. This has been fantastic. And
I'm sorry, too.
Yeah, it's been great fun, and we're going to have to decide that you're one of our regulars.
Thank you.
So I hope you'll be willing to come back again in the future.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Okay.
Enjoyed it.
We're going to talk about syphilis. I know we are.
Okay.
Till next time, this is WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro.